Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, we'll hear criticism on a proposal to just close the lowest performing schools in the state. But first, lately there have been a lot of accusations by Donald Trump that the elections could be rigged if he doesn't win. And there are a lot of concerns that the Russians hacked the Democratic Party's emails. The next question asked by many people is, what's to keep the Russians from hacking into election results? So let's ask the top guy in Michigan. Chris Thomas is the Michigan Elections Director at the Secretary of State's office, and he joins us now. So how secure is the elections process in Michigan?
Well, our system is extremely secure. And one of the main reasons, it's interesting, the FBI director is quoted today in the Wall Street Journal as saying the beauty of the American voting system is it is dispersed among 50 states and it is clunky as heck. So I never thought that being called clunky would be a great compliment, but I'll take it. It's a very decentralized system. There is no one big computer in the United States, or for that matter, in any state, that actually takes all the election returns and would be an easy target for somebody. That just doesn't exist.
Let's just walk through the process just a little bit. What's done to protect a voter's ballot as it makes its way from the precinct to the county clerk to your office?
Okay, well, let's look at election day. So the voter goes in and they show their ID. They're issued a ballot. They have a booth that they vote in.
Now, you say show your ID, but you don't have to do that in Michigan, right?
You do have to do that if you have your ID on you. If you don't have your ID with you or you don't have an ID, then you can sign an affidavit. We're not a hard ID state. You now have your ballot. You go to the booth. It's in a secrecy sleeve. You vote your ballot, you put it back in the secrecy sleeves, and then you carry it over to the tabulator. There's one tabulator in each polling place. They tear off the stub, which has a number on it. So now, once that stub is detached, it is truly a secret ballot. There's no way it can be brought back to you and connected to you. You feed it into the tabulator. The tabulator takes it. The important piece here we're talking about, it's a paper ballot. There's your audit trail. So if there's a recount later on, they're going to hand count that ballot. A lot of the discussion you hear around the country is with the touchscreen devices. We do not have that in Michigan. We have paper ballots. So when the polls close, the tabulator prints out a paper report on what the returns are for that precinct. These tabulators are not connected to the internet or any network.
So the Russians aren't going to be able to hack at the precinct level.
That's right.
Okay.
There's no Russians allowed. There's no way they can get into these boxes. These boxes are standalone. They are modem capable, but they're analog. So you got to plug them in to a phone line and send them off. These returns are then taken to the city or township clerk. They check everything. Now, remember, all the workers, there's a mix of Republican and Democratic Party precinct inspectors that are there. So this is a very open process. The returns go to the county eventually, where they are compiled in the county on election night. The ballots remain sealed in these transfer cases. So we have a very secure system.
So eventually, all of this information, all of this data gets to your office. How long have you been director of Michigan Elections?
I've been director since 1981.
So you've got a couple of elections under your belt. How many have you been able to rig over those years?
Well, I have rigged none. I don't even know where I would start to rig them.
It seems impossible to rig an election. Doesn't look like the Russians are going to be able to hack in to change the election results. There's only one other ballot question I had, and that's, you know, the Attorney General asked the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on Michigan eliminating straight party voting. That ruling came down. What did you hear today?
What we heard today is that by a 6-2 vote, they denied the application. So therefore, there will be straight party voting in Michigan this year. And one other point I want to make very clear to voters, because a lot of people don't seem to understand this. You can mark straight party on our ballots, and then you can go vote for candidates in other parties down the row. So by marking straight party on Michigan's ballot, you are not locked into that party. So if you have a party, you want to vote for it, you can do it. But if there's a candidate in the other party that you would prefer, you can go over and vote for that candidate.
I also like to remind people that there are down-ballot races that are nonpartisan, such as the Supreme Court races, and you have to keep in mind those aren't going to count if you just vote a straight party ticket.
That's exactly right.
That is Chris Thomas. He is Michigan Elections Director. Thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Glad to do it.
I was listening to the radio yesterday, and there was a report about a so-called die-in held at the Capitol in Lansing. It was organized by the Michigan Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence. We've also seen open carry protesters on the lawn of the Capitol. And if you spend any time there, you'll find a lot of different groups and interests either exhibiting or protesting. Joining us today, as they do on most Fridays, are Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow of Public Sector Consultants. Ken, I want you to pull back the curtain for us a little bit. As a former Republican leader in the legislature, I wonder how much these protests actually sway lawmakers.
As you pointed out, there are a lot of these all the time. To some extent, it depends on the issue. Some issues like guns and abortion are so polarizing that they probably don't move the needle. But I think some of these protests, if they have staying power, meaning if they do it year in and year out, can have an impact because they keep the issue in front of lawmakers.
Susan, you've covered the Capitol for a long time, and I assume, like me, you've actually probably a lot more often than me, you've interviewed those protesters. What impression do you think they have on lawmakers when they actually get some face time with them?
I think, to be honest, these protests have a limited effect at best in terms of swaying lawmakers. In terms of swaying public opinion, I think Ken is correct that if people do a sustained effort, it's not just a one and done, but try and keep their issue out there, that that can make an impact in terms of how people view that issue. But by and large, for lawmakers, and frankly, a lot of lawmakers won't even make time to meet with protesters if they are clearly on the other side of the particular issue. And if they do, and they disagree, it's usually just to humor them for a couple minutes. The days of protests, swaying votes, or passionate floor speeches, changing minds, are by and large over. Honestly, I'm not sure that I recall in my time covering the Capitol since 2006 where I ever saw that have an impact.
Ken?
The ones that have the best chance of success, meaning moving the needle on their issue, are the ones that have real staying power. For example, the motorcycle helmet law people that came in every single year until they got what they wanted, the repeal of the helmet law.
Primarily led by Abate.
Yeah, and it's, they just were there every single year, and then finally opportunity struck. They had the right sort of combination of legislators ideologically, but that's an example of the ones that have the best chance of success are the ones that are in for the long.
Susan, I want to ask you about, you know, our colleagues in the news. What do you think it says about the news coverage that we get this uneven coverage depending on how, you know, interesting the demonstration is?
I think by and large it's a reflection of the fact that there just are not as many reporters covering the Capitol anymore. And it's just impossible for a lot of news organizations nowadays, you know, especially TV, to just have the manpower to cover everything.
Okay, let's bottom line this. I'd like both of you to answer this. If you're passionate about an issue or a policy, what is the best way to make sure you're heard in an effective way?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. It's, you've got to have a lot of tools in the toolbox. You got to have your research done. You got to have the right advocacy. Doesn't hurt to make political contributions. Doesn't hurt to make yourself known with these type protests that have good visual impact. But regardless of what it is, I think you have to have staying power. The idea that you can come in and do it for a couple of years and get what you are advocating for, that's the exception to the rule. You really got to be in for the long term.
Susan, if someone's passionate about an issue or policy, what's the best way to make sure that you're heard in an effective way?
I think that consistency is what is key, not just in terms of continuing to do protests, which, you know, is important, but making sure that you're staying connected with legislators and with the media about your issue in a variety of ways. The more that you get your message out there, the more effective you're going to be. You know, it's sometimes really hard to break through because legislators have an enormous amount of issues before them. Obviously, doing the state budget, you know, a $50 billion budget is a huge undertaking year after year. And you have reporters that are pulled in every which direction to cover various things. But, you know, if you build relationships with people at the Capitol and in the press corps, you're certainly going to have a much greater chance of being noticed than people who show up to a protest once and then you never hear from them again.
Susan Demas is the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema is a former legislator and a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, the idea of closing 5% of Michigan's lowest performing schools doesn't sit well with one MSU professor. Then Muslims in the UP. And another installment of Artisans of Michigan. We introduce you to a Windsor chairmaker. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Has been rampant in the dark corners of the internet for a long time, and as close as Dearborn. Armed demonstrators have stood outside mosques and libraries in Dearborn protesting radical Islam, in quotes, or they were simply anti-Muslim. But there's a small enclave of Muslims in the Upper Peninsula who've not been ostracized. Dr. Osama Abdakhalik is a faculty member in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Michigan Tech University in Houghton. He's also an advisor for the Muslim Student Association there, and he joins us now via Skype. Doctor, when you made the decision to move to Houghton, a small town in a remote area that's very white and very Christian, what were your expectations?
I was first attracted to Michigan Tech as a school and a good place to work. And when I asked about the Muslim community, I was told that there are very few Muslims in the area over there. So it was a little, from that perspective, it was a little hazy picture. But when I moved there, I found that the people there are very nice and open for diverse. So it turned out to be very well after all.
How long have you lived there now?
9 years.
9 years. So that's some time to really get to know the community. How's that been? I mean, are you active with people throughout the community?
Yeah, more or less. I'm trying to, within the Muslim community, yes, I'm very active with them, engaged with them in the activities that we do. And also outside the Muslim community, in the overall in the town, we have especially recently we have had some mutual meetings with other communities in the area, just so to get people to know more about it, the Islamic religion in general and the Muslims who live in the area. I think it's I feel responsibility that we have to give more information for people about the true Islamic religion and Muslims.
Do you think it's more accepting because it's a college town?
Definitely. It's a college town, and by default, there is a wide range of diverse students in town. And so the people there are, they understand this. They understand diversity.
Two of your children are teenagers, and they've mostly grown up in Houghton. Your oldest daughter decided to wear hijab. Teenagers can be pretty rough on anyone who's even a little bit different. What kinds of concerns did you have about how your daughter might be treated at school?
That's a very good point. When my daughter decided to wear hijab, she made that decision on her own. And I remember that when at that time I have told her and that she might face some, let's say, troubles because of that, especially when it comes to friends and getting along with friends and colleagues. But she decided to do it, and I was amazed by the response from her friends. She never had a problem with that. And I can tell she had very good relations with her friends. They come over, they come for sleepover, and she visits all of them at their homes. So I'm really happy with that, which I can tell that's not the case probably in other places.
As we mentioned, you're an advisor to the Muslim Student Association at Michigan Tech. How have your students found their experiences? Have they seen the same kind of reception that you've received in Houghton?
I can say yes, because I have never, I can't remember that I have ever heard about a problem from or a complaint from one of the Muslim students. My answer is yes.
I understand you meet at a community center now. Are there plans to ever build a mosque in Houghton?
We would like to do that. And we have had a few meetings as a community. And we asked about the process for that. And, we started the process. We know it's a long way to go because we are a small community. But we started the process.
Diversity is valued at most higher ed institutions. I'm wondering how Michigan Tech reacted or, for that matter, marketed the fact that there's a small Muslim community there.
I can tell that Michigan Tech emphasizes highly on diversity, and they market their they have a lot of efforts in the diversity, and there is a diversity office, and there is a manager for that office and the group who work in that office. But I can't remember that they specifically talked about the Muslim community. They do a very good job in terms of diversity among all of the different religions and different ethnics. Nothing specific about Muslims that I can tell. But I can also say that whenever the Muslim student leaders go to school asking for help or advice, they have found what they always look for.
Dr. Osama Abdelkhalik, he's a faculty member at Michigan Tech University in Houghton and an advisor to the Muslim Student Association there. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. We've been visiting craftsmen and women around Michigan for our series, Artisans of Michigan. Today, let's visit Adrian, Michigan.
I'm making some Windsor chairs. Right now, I'm fitting the legs into the seat.
That's Luke Barnett of Barnett Windsor Chairs. Oh, and his sidekick, Samson. If you're not familiar with Windsor chairs, think of your grandma's house and that wood chair with the spindles of the back drilled into the seat. And the seat was so perfectly sculpted so it felt really nice to sit in. If you're still not sure, we've got some photos on our website at michiganradio.org. These chairs, these Windsor chairs, are what Barnett makes almost entirely by hand.
And they've been doing it like this since 1750, and I'm just trying to carry on that tradition.
Barnett's woodshop is in the Adrian Center for the Arts. It's a wooded campus with shops of all kinds of artists. It's fitting that his shop is surrounded by trees because these Windsor chairs are made out of three different kinds of wood, all found right here in Michigan.
The legs are made out of sugar maple. It takes very, very fine details on the lathe, so it's very fine grained. And actually, to my advantage, I live here in Adrian, Michigan, which is also known as the Maple City. The seats are traditionally made out of eastern white pine. It's because it's soft, it's very stable once it's dried, and we live here in Michigan, which the state tree is the eastern white pine, which is another advantage for me. Then the rest of the parts that are steam bent, the backs of the chairs and all the spindles are made out of white oak, and because white oak is very, very flexible, which makes it very, very comfortable. So instead of being a hard, rigid chair, It's actually more of like a hammock. So it flexes and conforms to your body. And if you come over here, I can just show you how flexible that these spindles are.
Yeah, you've got a half-inch play in each one.
Yeah, more so.
Barnett makes rocking chairs, armchairs, dining room chairs, even some Windsor-style stools. Barnett says he loves being in the shop. While some people take up woodworking as a hobby when they retire, he gets to do it for a living right now in his early 30s. It all started when he was about 12 years old, helping his grandmother restore rundown Victorian-era houses.
I would do her interior trim, and it kind of just started from there. Then I moved on to exterior work, architectural millwork. I moved into joinery and houses. Then I started making furniture, and then I started getting into Windsor chairs, and instead of seeing the complexity in the woodworking, I always see the simplicity, and that's a huge advantage, and I realize that, and I'm very grateful for that. So the Windsor chairs, I'm still learning, and I'm trying to get better every day, and with every chair, I think I get just a little bit better.
As part of this community of artists, Barnett also holds classes for the public. He teaches the basics of carving wood or woodworking with hand tools, but most of the time, he's by himself making chairs.
I kind of enjoy being by myself. That's when I get my best work done. I always have.
Well, he's never completely alone. His dog Samson is always nearby. That's Luke Barnett of Barnett Windsor Chairs, the latest in our series, Artisans of Michigan.
I think that's pretty good.
Up next, speaking out against civil asset forfeiture.
The government is able to take people's property even though they might actually not have done anything wrong.
Then in 10 minutes, we check in with a group volunteering to help Flint residents deal with lead-contaminated water. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Last year, Michigan tightened requirements for civil asset forfeiture. That's the law that allows the government to seize property when someone is accused of a crime, even if they're not convicted. This started as part of the war against drugs. It became a lucrative tool for cash-strapped police departments and prosecutors. Laws passed last year require more transparency in Michigan, but it does not abolish civil asset forfeiture. Also, there's been a recent appellate court ruling on this. One of the groups that's been calling for an abolishment or an end to civil asset forfeiture is the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Jarrett Skorup is a policy analyst for the Mackinac Center. Jarrett, would you explain what this is just a little more fully? What is civil asset forfeiture?
The civil forfeiture is, like you said, the ability for law enforcement to seize, and then the forfeiture is actually the transfer of the property over to the state. And the idea behind that is not necessarily a bad one. It's supposed to be you have where criminals gain possessions or gain revenue from doing something illegal, and so you need forfeiture in order to take the funds or the assets, and they use that for criminal work and then also to recompensate victims and things like that. The problem in Michigan and around the country is that this isn't just done in the criminal realm, it's done in civil realm, which is why it's called civil forfeiture, which means that when assets are seized and go through the civil system, it can happen before anybody is charged with, in many cases, even accused of a crime. So the government is able to take people's property even though they might actually not have done anything wrong.
I want to get to the Court of Appeals ruling, but first, what did the laws that were passed last year do specifically about the transparency of this law?
So right now, we know that the state takes about $20 to $25 million worth of assets every year, but we didn't know who that was coming from, whether the person was charged with a crime, what the assets were. We just didn't know a lot about it. And so law enforcement would make, when they make the case, hey, we're taking these from drug dealers and from these people who are bad people, well, we didn't really know how much of that was coming from them versus coming from people who were never charged with a crime. And so what the laws did was they said that they're going to have to start documenting that. We're going to know at beginning next year, we're going to know who these assets came from, what actually happened with the possessions, whether somebody challenged to try to get their stuff back. And so that's what the transparency bills did.
Now, the Mackinac Center has written about people who've been subjected to this law. Can you give us an example of how this works? Somebody who might be unjustly required to try to get their own stuff back.
Yeah, I can give a specific example, and then I can talk generally about how this works. A specific, probably the most infamous example happened a couple years ago. There were a bunch of people who went to an event down in Detroit at an art museum, and this art museum was accused of serving alcohol without a license. Now, they were checking people and making sure they were of age and all that, but they didn't have the proper license for Wayne County. And so the police came, and even though people were not alleged to have done anything wrong, they were in the vicinity of illegal activity. And so the police took seized their cars from everybody involved and then charged them in order to get their assets back. So that was a pretty, what we would say is a bad example, not charging someone with a crime. They still had to pay or they lost their vehicle. And then more broadly, unfortunately, the way that forfeiture works in Michigan is sometimes while somebody is going to go through the criminal process, the law enforcement will immediately take their stuff and then begin to start the proceedings of forfeiting it over to the state, even though the person hasn't yet been convicted of a crime. And the problem is that if you want a challenge to get your stuff back, to get your assets back, you have to pay a 10% bond up front. So to even begin the process of proving that your stuff wasn't involved in wrongdoing, you have to pay sometimes a large amount of money up front, and a lot of people, they're not able to afford and the ability to do that, which is what this court case was about.
Sure. If it's a car or your house, it could be a really significant cost. Mm-hmm. So recently, the State Court of Appeals ruled parts of the civil asset forfeiture law violates due process rights of defendants. What parts and how does it change the practice?
So the U.S. Constitution has, you know, we found that people have a right to an attorney, they have a right to a proper defense. And so what this court found was that there was a woman where the state seized a couple of vehicles from her, a bunch of her cash, and her home. And so she didn't have a lot of money, and so she was only able to come up with about $1,000. And so she couldn't get all of her stuff back. So she was only able to get some of it back. And eventually, at the end of the day, another court ruled that she was able, even though that she was in the right, essentially that she was found to not, the assets were not guilty of any type of crime. But in the meantime, she had lost these assets because she couldn't come up with the money to start the proceedings to get them back. So she thought that her home and her cars had nothing to do with the criminal activity that the state was talking about, but she didn't have enough money to hire an attorney or to put up the 10% bond to begin the challenge to get her products back.
I want to clarify one thing, because you keep saying the state took, but you really mean, I mean, state in a formal sense, local police, local prosecutors take and benefit from that money, correct?
Right. Yep. Great point. Yeah, I'm using state. So for the government, so this is done. This can be done for city. This can be done at the county level, or it can be done at the state level. Whoever is prosecuting the crime, or whoever has actually seized the assets.
Now, the federal government came up with this idea. It has since distanced itself from it, determining that civil asset forfeiture was bad policy. Yet states and local officials still are using it. I mean, for civil libertarians, the conflicts of interest, because cops and prosecutors are seizing things they're going to actually benefit from in their budgets. This conflict of interest and government overreach seemed obvious as soon as it was passed back in the 1980s. Why is it just now falling out of favor?
I think that for a long time, people didn't understand what was happening or how it was happening. And of course, a lot of times law enforcement, they just associate this with drug use. And so for a lot of people, they're thinking, well, it's drugs. That's a bad thing. So of course, they're not willing to get involved or to understand what's actually happening. From our standpoint, we're not necessarily saying, you know, that these are always good people or that this isn't used against criminals or anything like that. But we're a civil libertarian group, and people have constitutional rights. And if the police want to take ownership of somebody's property, they should have to prove and convict them of a crime. And Michigan has the worst of a couple of different worlds here, because as the money goes back to the department that initially seized people's assets. And so you have this incentive process set up, and it's been admitted by law enforcement. This is used to pad their budgets, and that's not how a criminal justice system should work. Certainly, a lot of times we should definitely be spending more money on law enforcement when they need it, but we shouldn't set up a system where local police departments are using this type of tool where they don't have to convict someone and they can gain revenue from it.
So that brings up the question I wanted to ask. How will police departments and prosecutors make up for this loss of seized revenue if this, for instance, is abolished eventually?
Well, in some areas, they've already begun having to do so just because local sheriffs have discretion over whether they want to allow their people to forfeit property. And there are a lot of counties and townships that just don't do it in the state of Michigan. So right now, we kind of have a two-tiered system because we have a lot of areas where they're doing forfeiture and they're using it all the time, and they're teaming up with federal officials to do so. And then we have others that aren't using it at all. But what I would say is that we should just look at that from the townships should look at that, cities themselves, and the local government. And if police aren't getting enough money, they should go through the legislative process to make that case just the way everybody else does.
So is the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in favor of abolishing civil asset forfeiture?
Yes. Our position is that we should get rid of civil forfeiture. The only way that the government should be able to forfeit, take ownership of somebody's assets and property, is after they've been convicted of a crime, and then that same judge and jury determine that their crime was connected with gaining the assets. And at that point, that's the only time they should take those products.
Jared Skorup is a policy analyst for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This weekend, the group Crossing Water is calling for some volunteers to do what they've been doing for a long time now, helping Flint residents deal with the water contamination there. Michael Hood joins us. I saw a short video of Crossing Water's Facebook page where you were describing some of the problems you're finding when you visit homes in Flint. That was August 27th, I think. Tell us what you are finding when you visit these homes going door-to-door knocking.
Well, we actually get referred to these homes, so we don't cold call or canvas. But the homes that we visit, we're finding a lot of stuff. We're seeing lots of issues, lots of trauma, things that predate the water crisis, and the water crisis really has just exacerbated so many things in these homes. But in general, we're seeing still a good number of homes. Over 50% of the homes we're seeing have filtered issues, documented filter issues. Either their filter's not hooked up right, it's not hooked up at all. It's not working. They've run hot water through it, or they don't have a filter at this late date.
That's amazing. Now, are these people who might once have had a filter, or they've just never been contacted about this and told how important it is?
You have about 10, maybe 8 to 10, maybe 12 different factors involved here. There's a pretty high illiteracy rate with some populations in the city and some neighborhoods. And so there's folks that can't read the instructions on the packages. There's folks that have run hot water through the filter for any number of reasons. They have children that have maybe done it, maybe adults with cognitive issues.
So that runs the filter?
Yeah. And then you also have situations where folks have plumbing that is not compatible with the filter. So we've actually had to go in and pull out plumbing from homes and replace that plumbing just to get a working filter in that home. So these are just a number of the things that we see in these homes. But right, as I said, over 50% of the homes that we visit face-to-face, we're seeing these problems right now. And it's just unacceptable. It's unbelievable, really, given that the state is saying that everyone's got a filter, everyone's doing just fine. It just couldn't be further from the truth.
Now, tell me a little bit more about what you're doing. Are you exclusively helping people with their filter issues, or is there more?
We're a full-service humanitarian relief and crisis intervention agency. So we bring water, first and foremost. It's about water. We bring lots and lots of water. We bring filters, cartridges. We do water education, which is our bread and butter. We do filter inspections and plumbing inspections to make sure that those filters are working. But more important than that, to make sure that the residents in the home understand the workings of those filters and how they're best used and how best not to use them. There's several high-risk populations that we're recommending not use filter water at this point and still use bottled water. So we give out those educational pieces. We also deliver food, formula education for new mothers and expectant mothers. We drop off clothing. We've done furniture. We've done a furnace installation. We've done decks, put in decks for handicapped, disabled individuals. We drop off children's books, children's toys.
It's a broad spectrum of stuff, but water is the most important, clearly.
It's the most important. But folks that are suffering in this water crisis have decades of suffering from other issues. And so we're trying to deal with all these back issues as well, because we realize that putting people right with water is just going to put them to where they were before this crisis. And tens of thousands of people in the city of Flint have been suffering for a great many years for lots of social service deficits and other things as well.
Some of our reporters have talked to a lot of Flint folks who've completely lost confidence in government. And even when they are told, if you use a filter, in most cases, the water will be safe enough for you to drink, they're just not buying that at all. They're going for bottled water. How many people are you running into that just doesn't believe in anything the government says and is exclusively going with bottled water? And is there enough bottled water? Because we've been seeing those donations diminish.
Absolutely. Those are some big questions. Most of the residents we see, the vast, vast majority of residents we see, do not want to use the filters. We have to really spend a lot of time with residents to let them know that the filters are working, even at levels above their ratings. The water is getting better, but people don't trust it. They don't trust what they've been told by almost anybody. Now, having said that, Crossing Water has a pretty strong reputation amongst many neighbors, many residents in the city of Flint. But we want to be very careful about how we use that political capital to sell this concept, because people just aren't buying it, and they've been lied to by a good many people. One of the big issues around the filters is trust. I mean, the problem is there isn't enough water. At some point, there's not going to be enough water. The federal government has now turned over water distribution to the state, and the state is going to get out of this sooner than later, I predict, only because there's elections coming up. I shouldn't say only, but in addition to that fact, there's elections coming up, and we're seeing this crisis being politicized on many levels. We've already had water distribution, water given to us by the state, cut back on Saturdays, which is our biggest day. We can no longer get water delivered to us on Saturdays as an agency. And there's a lot of folks who are now getting less water delivered to them from the pods and from other sources. So,
not to be an apologist for the Snyder administration, but they have said they're going to continue to keep bringing water to Flint and to take care of this problem. That's what the governor's office is saying.
And they have said a lot of things to date. They have said a lot of things to date. I think that I'm going to get myself in trouble. I think the Snyder administration has written a book on how not to respond to a disaster. They have written a beautiful textbook on how not to deal with a crisis in an urban setting, and they're doing it well, if that's the standard. So whatever they tell us, we frankly can't afford to believe it. So we go on what we see on the ground. We go on what we can see, touch, and feel, and that's what we go with.
I want to ask you to just step back one big step and tell me whether you think there's been any improvement since you started visiting homes months and months ago.
Well, we started this in the snows of January, and we're still doing this work. And I can say maybe around the edges we've seen a little improvement, only because the water's getting a little bit better, which it's of course going to at some point. So the water's getting better. It's not still very good water by any stretch, but it's getting better. More people have filters. More people have cartridges. But at this point, here it is September, and we're seeing over 50% of residents that we visit face-to-face don't have working filters or need some intervention in filters. How is that acceptable after this long being engaged with us? So, you know, that to me is unconscionable. So we're not seeing a lot of improvement. The numbers have gone down a little bit, but they're kind of stayed in that place. We've gone back to homes that we visited months ago, and we're finding that those folks aren't able to use the filters correctly, even after getting a good bit of training and education. So we're finding a lot of folks are showing a secondary level of trauma because they've been at this for so long. We have parents who are taking care of children who don't know where their next case of water is going to come from. They're not on the bus line. They don't have a car. They have to spend their whole days or whole week around finding water for their family and their children. So these are still big issues, and those haven't diminished. The state has programs in place. The county does. The United Way, Red Cross, and so on. But there's a lot of holes in a lot of programs. And as a result, a lot of people still are in need. I ran into some folks just last week who were never offered a filter, never offered a filter. Here it is, you know, August, September, and folks still don't have a filter in their home. And not by choice. They were never offered one, and no one told them they were supposed to have one. I don't know how this happens. So there's your long answer to your question.
So the Flint water crisis far from over.
Far from over. We've been engaged since January, and we don't see any ending to this for a long time, especially if people are getting the level of services they are now, and knowing that those services are going to continue to diminish, we're going to see a level of need that's going to continue on until next year or later.
Michael Hood is with the group Crossing Water. They're working in Flint to try to help people cope with the contaminated water there. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You can learn more about Crossing Water and what you can do to help by going to the website crossingwater.org or follow them on Facebook. Stateside's producers are Allie Billings, Ryan Grimes, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.